This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday, the 26th of August, these are our main stories. The Ukrainian president says Russia targeted his country with about 200 missiles and drones on Monday. He's urging his allies to use their air defence capabilities to intercept attacks in Ukrainian airspace. There have been a string of attacks in southwestern Pakistan. In the worst single incident, ethnic Punjabis appear to have been singled out and then shot. Also in this podcast, we'll hear from one of the treatment centres in the Democratic Republic of Congo, overwhelmed with Mpox patients.
We are full of fear because we are crowded in our shelters, we sleep in very poor conditions, we share beddings. Prevention is difficult, and because of that, we are afraid.
And Germany suggests it'll toughen its approach to what it's calling irregular migrants. Russia has launched a large-scale missile and drone barrage on Ukraine. More than half of its regions were targeted and the whole country was put on air raid alert. President Zelensky has appealed for more help from his Western allies.
In our various regions of Ukraine, we could do much more to protect lives if the aviation of our European neighbours worked together with our F-16s and together with our air defence. If such unity has worked so well in the Middle East, it should work in Europe as well.
I've been talking to our reporter Abdujalil Abdurasulov in Kyiv.
We're now just getting the latest figures about the scale of this attack, and President Volodymyr Zelensky has stated that Russia used more than 100 missiles and about another 100 drones to target cities across Ukraine. So you can only imagine, you know, the scale of this attack just looking by this sheer number of missiles and drones that Russia launched. And also among the weapons that they used, the cruise missiles and Shahed drones, Russia also launched ballistic missiles, Kinjal missiles, to target cities in Ukraine. And these missiles are much harder to intercept. And we're still waiting for reports from the Air Force about how many targets they managed to intercept, and which would give us an indication how many missiles and drones managed to go through and to pass through the defense systems. But it's clear that some of those missiles did cause some damage, possibly from falling debris. We're getting reports that the buildings in Poltava region, in Lutsk, in Odessa, in other regions as well, were damaged during the attack. And we're hearing reports that at least four people have been killed in the attack. According to the Prime Minister of Ukraine, Denis Shmyhal, more than half of the Ukrainian regions were affected by these air barrages.
The Kremlin said that there will be a response to Ukraine's incursion into Western Kursk. Now, the way their statement puts it is that there will be a response. It seems increasingly clear that what we've seen is part of the response.
Possibly, this could be Russia's attempt to retaliate following the Ukrainian armed forces incursion into the Russian region of Kursk. This could be a possibility, of course, but this is not the only time when Russia launched such a massive attack. Only last month, Russia hit the Ukraine's biggest children's hospital in Kyiv, and also they launched dozens of missiles and drones at that time as well. So such attacks happen quite frequently, and it is, of course, difficult to say that this one was definitely linked to the Kursk incursion. This is rather a general policy that Russia have been carrying out throughout this war.
Abdujalil Abdurasulov with me from Kyiv. At least 39 people have been killed in southwestern Pakistan after a gunman stopped vehicles and forced their occupants out. Local media reports say the attackers questioned the ethnicity of the travellers before deciding whether to shoot them. Here's our Pakistan correspondent, Caroline Davis.
The largest number of deaths occurred late on Sunday when, according to police, attackers stopped several vehicles travelling between Punjab and Balochistan. They forced the passengers out and opened fire on them. According to media reports citing the police, the attackers checked IDs before shooting. Those reports say that most of the victims were from Punjab. The incident took place around 450 kilometres from the province's capital, Quetta. Other attacks are reported to have taken place in Kalat, where security personnel were amongst the dead, and in Balan, where several bodies were discovered near a bridge that had been blown up. The separatist group, the Baluch Liberation Army, has released a statement saying that they've conducted operations throughout the province, including attacks on people travelling in buses. Not all of the incidents they've claimed have been confirmed by Pakistani officials. Trains have been suspended between Baluchistan and the rest of the country. Pakistan's interior minister has said that those involved would not escape what he called a fateful end.
More than 10 months of airstrikes have left much, perhaps most, of Gaza in ruins, a worsening humanitarian situation and an increased threat of disease now as well. Over the weekend, the World Health Organization confirmed its first case of polio in Gaza in 25 years. It was contracted by a 10-month-old baby. There's a UN effort now underway to try to get more than a million polio vaccines into Gaza. I've been hearing more about this from our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher.
The alarm was sounded a couple of weeks ago when there were samples taken from the earth in Gaza back at the end of June, which showed traces of a polio virus. And then, as you say, a week or so ago, there was news that a 10-month-old baby had its leg paralysed after contracting the disease, and that was confirmed by the WHO just a few days ago. And again, as you say, this is the first outbreak, if one can call it that, the first case to be detected in Gaza in 25 years. And that's down, as again, as you're saying, to the mass devastation, the collapse of a health system, sanitation, etc., all the things which lead to disease and to polio as one of them. Yes, and the fear is, as the UN has put it, that this isn't just a disease that's confined to Gaza. This could spread to Israel. This could spread beyond. So there's been a mass move by the UN to provide these vaccinations, and they started to go in on Sunday.
So the World Health Organization clearly has access to a large number of vaccine doses. It can get them there. It's saying it can only get them there if there's a pause in the fighting.
Yes. I mean, that is what it was saying about a week ago, saying that it wants to deliver the vaccinations to more than 600,000 children who could be at risk. But then in order to do so with most Palestinians displaced, it's not exactly the case that you can go door to door as you would with a normal vaccination campaign. They need to have centres that they will create where people can come. But how can they get there with the fighting still raging? So they called for 2 7-day pauses in the fighting, called on both Israel and Hamas to allow that to happen. Now, we've had no sign, obviously, but that's about to happen. So they're saying that they're still going to go ahead with it and do the best they can, but it's going to be very difficult.
And just looking at what's going on more broadly, we've obviously had much worse violence on the border between Israel and Lebanon over the weekend. What impact does that have on the possibility of ceasefire talks relating to Gaza?
They're separate in a way, obviously. I think there might be an argument that Hamas had wanted Hezbollah to do more, that that would help its bargaining position and will be dissatisfied that its attack wasn't as strong. The ceasefire talks have continued, but with no breakthrough. The US has been talking it up hugely, but the other mediators, Hamas itself, even Israel, have suggested that big obstacles still remain. So we're still without any real breakthrough.
Now, staying with the Middle East, Lebanon has announced 3 days of mourning following the death of its former Prime Minister Salim al-Hoss, who was 94. He served as Prime Minister during most of the Lebanese civil war that lasted from 1975 to 1990. I spoke to our former Middle East correspondent Jim Muir, who's in Beirut, and knew Mr. al-Hoss well.
If you're writing a book about him, I think you'd probably entitle it something like A Thoroughly Decent Man, because that's what he was. And that in Lebanon, I have to say, is extremely rare. I mean, I can think of the range of politicians now. I mean, they all have their followers who revere them, but mainly it has to be said on a kind of sectarian basis. They're all up to their necks in corruption, basically. Nobody's ever suggested that Salim al-Hoss was like that. He was prime minister 3 or 4 times, depending on how you count it, because two of his premierships kind of merged, and one of them was very controversial because at one stage he was prime minister in West Beirut and General Michel Aoun, the army commander, had made kind of Christian prime minister in eastern Beirut. So the country was divided. They couldn't agree on a president. So for quite a while there was a country with no president and 2 rival prime ministers, of whom he was one. But as I say, he was totally regarded with respect, didn't get rich, and he basically, he was sort of slightly, I would say, leftist in his views. He believed in helping the common man, and that's what he dedicated his life to.
Obviously, he was playing a pretty crucial role during the tumultuous years in Lebanon that you've described. You met him several times. What was he like to spend time with?
He always was extremely generous with his time. Any time I wanted to talk to him, I'd phone up and he'd say, come on round, and we'd have a chat. He had humour. He was just very accessible and very kind of non-sectarian. He had to be a Sunni Muslim because the Prime Minister, except during the days of General Aoun, the Christian Prime Minister, which he shouldn't really have been, the Prime Minister traditionally is always a Sunni Muslim. Look, he wasn't a Sunni zaim or leader, like he didn't have a militia or anything like that. He was just a thoroughly accessible, almost a technocrat. He was an economist, a kind of specialist. He wasn't a kind of doctrinaire politician who tried to impose his views on everybody.
Jim Muir with me from Beirut. The recent ceasefire in the Democratic Republic of Congo has been broken, with fighting between the army and the rebels, both sides accusing each other of breaching the agreement. The continuing violence in the east has not only displaced millions of people, but also complicates efforts to fight the mpox virus outbreak. The latest statistic given to the BBC is that the majority of those being treated for mpox, about 70%, are children under the age of 10. We've also been given access to two treatment centres in eastern DRC. Our Africa correspondent Simi Chaloso reports.
Children at this hospital in Kavumu in South Kivu appear weary and in pain. This includes two-year-old Ansima, who caught mpox from one of her five siblings, who have all had the disease. Her mother, Inzigire Kanigo, had no idea what it was.
This is the first time I've seen it. When my child got sick, other parents told me it might be measles, but we started treating measles and failed, so we decided to come here. Three are cured and they're at home. I only have two who I am admitted with now in this hospital. I thank God.
Doctors at this hospital say there's been high demand for beds and medicines, but not enough supply. It's had 800 mpox patients since June. More than 70% have been children. Eight have died. About 100 miles away, in a treatment centre in Munigi near Goma, six-year-old Amani skips around his room. He is finally recovering from mpox after 4 days of free treatment. His father, Anen Mataboro, describes what it was like.
It began like a small inflamed spot. The mother squeezed it and watery discharge came out. Then another developed. And after a short period, they were all over.
Like the hospital, three quarters of patients here have been under the age of 10. Dr. Pierre-Olivier Ngajole, who works for the charity MEDAIR, told the BBC they've had up to 10 new cases a day.
The IDP camps are overcrowded. So you see children in the IDP camps, they are always playing together. They don't really care about social distance, they don't care about that. And you can also see, like, in the household, they even pass the night on the same bed. You can find 3, 4, 5 children. So the contact is very so close and is very permanent. So that means the transmission is really present on a daily basis.
This region in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo is filled with millions of people who have been displaced because of an ongoing armed conflict. They can be crammed in makeshift structures at camps where the living conditions are often poor and lack good sanitation. The perfect place for mpox to run rampant. Charity workers are trying to get ahead by teaching people about symptoms, stigma and hygiene. The message resonates with some at Muja camp in Nyiragongo, but it doesn't suppress their fear.
We have been sensitized, but we are full of fear because we are crowded in our shelters. We sleep in very poor conditions, we share beddings, so prevention is difficult. And because of that, we are afraid.
We have children in the house. Tell our leaders to send us medicine soaps and other protective measures so that we don't get infected.
The government is hopeful mpox vaccinations will begin this week, with children first in line. But the incessant conflict will pose a challenge.
Simi Jalasa reporting. Still to come in this podcast, a new video game based on Welsh folklore.
So he explained it was a Welsh language game. It was quite exciting that it was the Mabinogion, so I jumped at the chance, really.
The former manager of the England football team, Sven-Göran Eriksson, has died. He was 76 and in January revealed he'd been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. He won multiple awards at club level and as a Swede was the first non-English manager of the England team in 2001. He often got a hard time from mass circulation newspapers in the UK. Here he is in 2005 speaking about the pressures of the job.
The pressure is on England, the pressure is on Brazil, Argentina, Italy, Holland, a lot of Sweden team as well, of course, to do very well. But I think that's good. I'm not suffering from that. I want to have a job where pressure is very, very high. Because if you don't have a lot of pressure on the team you're working with, that means you have a very bad team. And who wants to have a bad team? We know that we have a good team. We know the pressure is enormously. But I'm sure that the players can cope with that, live up to that. Then we'll see what's happening in the tournament. We need a little bit of luck to do what we want to do.
My colleague Nigel Adderley works as a football journalist and had interviewed Sven-Göran Eriksson a number of times. I asked Nigel how big a deal it was for him to be the first non-English manager.
It was absolutely huge. And I think Sven, who was the headline on many of the newspapers, because although he'd had success across Europe, particularly in Italy, for the Football Association in England to go for a foreign manager, it was seen as a massive step. And he also took charge of the so-called golden generation at the time, players like David Beckham, Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard. There were plenty of highly talented players with large egos in the dressing room, but he was a very good coach, but he was also a very good man manager within those dressing rooms. He was a charming presence on and off the field, possibly didn't get the best out of the team, maybe, that he should have done, finishing with three quarterfinals during his time as England manager at major tournaments. But there's no doubt the players loved him, and those of us in the football media loved him, but certainly he did have issues with the wider press in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, you can hear the sort of calm charm just in that little bit of him there. Prince William, in the last few minutes, has described him as a true gentleman of the game. He did get a lot of pressure, you know, partly because of the team's performances by the end, but also this whole business of not being English. Just give us a sense of what the newspapers used to do to him.
Well, also, he did have a very colourful private life as well, and there were a number of affairs off the field during Sven-Göran Eriksson's time as England coach, and he found himself often on the front pages as much as he was on the back on the sports pages. And he always seemed bemused by that, because when he was a coach in Sweden and around Europe, his private life was private. Nobody discussed it. But once you become the England manager with the English press, you become public property as well. And he never quite got to grips with that. And when he did have issues with his private life, I think in the end, it became an issue with the Football Association as well. And that's why he was possibly removed as the England coach before his time. But I think today many people will remember him as a charming man and also a very good football coach.
Just days after a stabbing at a festival in the German town of Solingen on Friday, the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has pledged to strengthen laws on gun ownership and crack down on illegal migration. A Syrian man who came to Germany as an asylum seeker has been charged with the attack, in which three people died and eight were injured. Prosecutors say the man is also suspected of being a member of the Islamic State group. Mr. Scholz went to Solingen on Monday to lay flowers in memory of the victims.
Übrigens gilt das auch im Hinblick auf die Zahl derjenigen, die irregulär sich nach Deutschland begeben.
Incidentally, this also applies to the number of those who enter Germany irregularly. The number must go down, and therefore it's good news that through the decisions we've now made, in particular the border controls that we've newly established, that we've managed to reduce the number of people who come to Germany irregularly.
Our correspondent in Berlin is Damien McGuinness.
I think what was interesting about what Mr. Scholz said earlier today was that he would ensure that those who didn't have a right to stay in Germany would be deported. The question is, how do you do that? And I think what a lot of experts have been saying here today is that the legal mechanism's already there. But what we saw in Solingen was a failing from the logistical side, from the regional government, which didn't manage to find the suspect when he was due to be deported. There are lots of big questions, humanitarian questions, but legal questions about how you deport someone whose application for asylum has been rejected by the authorities. In the case of this particular suspect, he had travelled from Bulgaria, had come to Germany as a Syrian. Most Syrians generally get their application for asylum accepted in Germany. In his case, it was rejected because he had already registered in Bulgaria. But if you can't find the person, which is the case here, then it's very difficult to deport them. The other question is, if he was going to have to be deported back to Syria, at the moment that wouldn't be possible from Germany because there is no agreement to do that, and Syria is seen as not a safe place and a country at war. The other proposal from conservative politicians is sending people back to Afghanistan, because there's a lot of people who have come to Germany from Afghanistan. And some of those don't get their applications for asylum accepted. But that's also not possible right now logistically, because there is no agreement with the Taliban. And Berlin does not want to talk with the Taliban about sending people back. You have to pay to do it. You have to negotiate with the government. And that's not something Berlin wants to do with the Taliban. So on the one hand, you can have strong words. On the other, if it's not legally possible, or from a humanitarian view possible, or even logistically possible, it'll be very difficult to enforce.
Damien McGuinness in Berlin. Over the past week, heavy rain in Sudan has killed dozens of people, compounding hardship in a country that's already facing multiple crises. Now at least 60 people have been killed after a dam in the east collapsed. The dam in Red Sea State supplied water to Port Sudan, where the military government is based. Our Africa regional editor Richard Kagoe is covering the story from Nairobi.
The tropical storm hit the region, causing a massive downpour, and the sheer volume of water compromised the structure of this dam. It's a major dam, actually. And because there's lots of sediment, then what happened is that it sort of like got overwhelmed, and that affected the integrity of the dam's structure. So as a result of that, the water spilled over and went downstream and swept away villages, agricultural farms, especially even orchards. And lots of people are reported to have been stranded, and they're desperately needing, you know, assistance right now, because you just have a picture of the dam. You can see large swaths of land that have been covered in rainwater.
And what's the state of the rescue effort in that part of the country, Richard?
We've just heard from one of the government officials, specifically in charge of the Ministry of Water and, of course, Disaster Management. What they're saying is that they have embarked on rescue and search operations. But, of course, this has really been hampered because of the rains there, and also the amount of water that have covered, you know, the affected region. So it's still in the initial stages, but lots of difficulties, you know, just rolling out this exercise.
And obviously this is a country where there's violence and conflict going on. What will the impact be on that, do you think?
It's really bad news for Sudan, because this particular dam was constructed specifically to collect rainwater, store it, and then ensure that there's year-round availability of water in the region, because this is sort of like a desert region. And so this dam was supplying water both for domestic and agricultural production in Port Sudan. So Port Sudan is currently where the Sudanese army has based its operations next to the Red Sea. So a lot of people have been affected by this, are going to be affected, will feel the impact of this, because a lot of small farming communities depend on this. And of course, even the operations within de facto capital, which hosts lots of displaced people and humanitarian organizations, plus the Sudanese army's operations in that city. So we're going to see lots of impacts, especially when it comes even to the war.
Our Africa regional editor, Richard Kagoe. The Paralympics begin in Paris on Wednesday, and Ukraine's team will be hoping to continue their remarkable success story. They finished near the top of the medal table at recent Games, but their preparations for Paris have been badly affected by the war with Russia. Andy Swiss has been to meet some of the contenders as they trained, starting with the swimmers.
He's one of Ukraine's biggest Paralympic hopes. Danilo Chuforov, who's visually impaired, survived 3 weeks of shelling before his house was destroyed.
I was ready to die. I hoped I would survive, but the probability of dying was so high that you just put up with it.
Over the last 20 years, Ukraine's Paralympians have become heroes at home, one of the most successful teams in the world. But they say around 500 of their sports facilities have been destroyed. Chuforov now trains here near Dnipro, where he's often interrupted by air raid sirens. Many athletes have had to move abroad. Fencer Andrei Demchuk has been training in Poland with their team. But he's gone back to Ukraine, where he speaks to injured soldiers about adapting to life with a prosthetic. He's even delivered jeeps to help the war effort, driving them with a little help from his fencing sword.
I have only one normal leg and three pedals. And for me, I can help with a broken epi or foil and push the clutch. After, I can push my left leg to another two pedals, and this is a little problem. Every day, all what I do for my country.
At the Paris Olympics, 15 Russian athletes took part as neutrals, their only medal in tennis. But at the Paralympics, 90 are set to compete. For Ukrainian swimmer Anna Honter, who had to move to Finland after the invasion, facing them will not be easy.
I will be try to close my emotion, but I don't know how it will be going.
Will it give you an extra motivation to win in the Paralympics?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I want to win. I want to fight for Ukrainian, for our my family, for our Paralympic team, and I want to fight.
That challenge has never been greater, but Ukraine will be hoping their Paralympic success story can continue against all the odds.
Andy Swiss reporting. Video games often feature heroes and villains with outstanding or even supernatural abilities. Not characters from Welsh folklore, though, until now. The classic collection of Welsh folk tales, the Mabinogion, has been used as the inspiration for a new Canadian video game. The tales were collected 800 years ago, although some of them date back hundreds or even thousands of years more. And some of the protagonists will be starring in a new computer game developed by Stephen Anastasov, who stumbled across the book while delving into his own Welsh heritage. Our reporter, Mellory Williams, went to meet him.
Mythical characters Pryderi, Branwen and Blodeuwedd may be familiar to many here in Wales. The Welsh tales of the Mabinogion date back to around the 12th and 13th centuries, and the characters are about to enter a new world of video games.
There's Welsh heritage in my family.
From Canada, here's the developer, Stephen Anastasov.
There are some really good interpretations, kind of more accessible interpretations, but not a lot. You know, it's hard to find. I mean, you really need to look if you're trying to find something a bit more accessible in terms of an interpretation of the Mabinogion. So I think certainly, you know, doing it in a video game format, it brings it to a whole different type of audience.
And from Canada to a studio in the Swansea Valley, Phil Rowe from Estelavera has been voicing the script.
Stefan contacted me out of the blue, really. I think he'd stumbled across my website. So he explained it was a Welsh language game. It was quite exciting that it was the Mabinogion. So I jumped at the chance, really, to work with him. And of course, him having worked on Assassin's Creed, and so it was quite exciting to work on.
So how much of a milestone is this to the characters of the Mabinogion? Here's Professor Sean Ed Davis from Cardiff University.
I think it's very important that we preserve these stories in popular culture. I think it's a wonderful idea, especially since it's going to be in Welsh only with the subtitles, because that's going to give a platform to the Welsh language as well internationally. I think it's important that we respect the origin of the stories, that we continue with our research into the stories, academic research, but it's so important that these stories live on. And in order to live on, they must adapt. Hey.
In a games club for Welsh speakers in Swansea, there's excitement ahead of the launch of the video game next spring.
It's really exciting to see Welsh culture and Welsh language in a video game. As far as I'm aware, it's never been done before. So that's really exciting, I think, for everybody who plays video games and is interested in Welsh culture and language.
I guess the thing is, everyone has different interests, and, like, you know, for some people it might be books in Welsh that helps them to kind of get into it. For some people it might be, I've heard a lot of people saying, like, listening to the radio, honestly, in Welsh, like, just on the way to work really helps them, like, get into that headspace. So this is great for the people who are obviously into video games, because from what I know, there's not a lot of that out there.
Opening another industry's eyes to a Welsh mythical treasure, from Canada to Wales and beyond.
Mallory Williams reporting. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or on X, we are @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Paul Mason. The producer was Ed Horton. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.